utgrantfoundation.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to look back at the Texas shooting massacre that occurred Sunday morning at a church in a small town in Texas. We're going to talk about what can be done to reduce gun violence. Later, we're going to talk about the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. That's all coming up today on Radioactivity. Well, the gunman who killed 26 people at that small town Texas church had a history of domestic violence that spanned years before the attack, and was able to buy weapons because the Air Force did not submit his criminal history to the FBI as required by military rules. If the past offenses by Devin Patrick Kelly, who fired at least 450 rounds at helpless worshipers on Sunday morning, had been properly shared, they would have prevented him from buying a gun, the Air Force acknowledged yesterday. Investigators also revealed that Kelly had sent threatening text messages to his mother-in-law, a member of the First Baptist Church, before the attack, and that sheriff's deputies had responded to a domestic violence call in 2014 at his home involving a girlfriend who became his second wife. Later that year, he was formally ousted from the Air Force for a 2012 assault on his ex-wife in which he choked her and struck her son hard enough to fracture his skull. Based on evidence at the scene of the crime, investigators believe Kelly died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after he was chased by bystanders, one of whom was armed, and then Kelly crashed his car. The 26-year-old shooter also used his cell phone to tell his father he had been shot and did not think he would survive, authorities said. While in the military, Kelly served in logistics readiness at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico from 2010 until his 2014 discharge, Air Force spokespeople said. He was discharged for the assault involving his previous wife and her child and served a year of confinement after a court-martial. Under Pentagon rules, information about convictions of military personnel for crimes such as assault should be submitted to the FBI's Criminal Justice Investigation Services Division. The Air Force says the service is launching a review of its handling of the case and taking a comprehensive look at its databases to ensure other cases have been reported correctly. We're going to talk now with Andrew Patrick. He is with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He's the media director. And Andrew, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So what do you make of, so far, the Air Force's statement that it did not share the information properly with the FBI about the shooter's history of domestic violence?
Well, it's certainly not good news. This is clearly someone who was dangerous. He was threatening a history of animal abuse, a history of domestic abuse. I believe he cracked his son's skull. He should not have had a gun, and the proper channel should have been followed to make sure that he was unable to purchase guns. He ended up purchasing four.
Do you think other people have slipped through and been able to purchase guns, even though they, by law, should not have purchased guns?
I mean, this is one of the big things we talk about, not only universal background checks, making sure everyone goes through a background check, but making sure that the background check system is properly implemented. And the right information is in there. We saw a similar situation, different, but in the Charleston shooting, where the right information had not gotten through the NICS system, and which is the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, and it allowed that person to get a gun and go shoot the church in Charleston. So it's definitely something we need. The proper funding, the proper implementation, and just make sure we dot our I's and cross our T's and make sure these dangerous people do not have access to these weapons.
Let's talk about the guns that he had. How was he able to shoot 450 shots? What kind of guns did he have?
Uh, I know in the church they said it was a Ruger AR-15, which has kind of become the standard weapon of choice for these mass shootings in Aurora and Sandy Hook elsewhere. It is a it's an assault rifle, and it allows, it's a weapon of war, and it allows him to shoot as many people as he possibly can in a short amount of time. It is a very lethal weapon, and that is why so many people were shot and killed and shot and injured.
Now, let's listen to what President Trump said this morning when he was in South Korea. He was asked whether or not there should be a ban on weapons, and this is what he had to say.
I can only say this. If he didn't have a gun, instead of having 26 dead, he would have had hundreds more dead. So that's the way I feel about it.
So, you know, there he's saying that that this shooter in Texas was stopped by another person who had a gun nearby, and that that prevented a further tragedy. What do you, it's to the point that Wayne LaPierre made a few years ago after Sandy Hook that nothing stops a bad guy with a gun except a good guy with a gun. What do you say?
Well, first of all, no one stopped the shooting. There's 26 people who are dead. Almost half of them are children, the youngest being an 18-month-old. This shooting wasn't stopped. A dangerous person was allowed to have a weapon and was able to kill a lot of people. The people who chased after him did what they thought was necessary to do, but that is the NRA's vision. It is guns everywhere, gun firing. I think it's quite dangerous that these individuals who confronted them were not mistaken for the shooter and shot by the police. That's always a concern when you have this sort of good guy with a gun myth that's been promoted by the National Rifle Association and the gun lobby. We want to focus on making sure dangerous people don't have guns. I think having an armed society is only going to get more people killed and only going to make it more dangerous. Most of the time, it adds to the confusion of the situation than actually preventing anything.
So, Andrew, what is the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, your group? What does it advocate in terms of what could be done to stop these mass shootings that seem to be on the increase?
Yeah, we support legislation and policies that will keep dangerous people from getting guns. We work a lot in the domestic violence laws, making sure if you've been convicted of a domestic violence, you should not have access to a gun. We work a lot with some laws that have passed on the West Coast in California, Oregon, and Washington State that are restraining orders that allow family members to recognize that one of their loved ones is either talking about committing a crime with a gun or talking about taking their own life with a gun. It allows them to go to a court and remove that gun from that individual for a period of time and then allow them to get help. So we want to pass these laws. We work with Congress. We also want universal background checks. But we are constantly trying to come up with new solutions and ways to reduce the amount of gun violence, and it starts with taking guns out of dangerous hands.
Well, what about banning these weapons that can fire 450 rounds in a short period of time? Is your group in favor of that?
The assault weapons ban, the high-capacity magazine ban, the bump stock ban that came up after Las Vegas, these are, it doesn't take away anyone's Second Amendment rights to make guns less lethal. You're able to kill a lot of people in a short period of time with these weapons that are supposed to be on the battlefield. Not for hunting deer, and I think that we'll see more legislation come up, and depending on what that legislation looks like, we'd be inclined to support these types of bans on these dangerous machines.
Bump stocks have been talked about a lot since the Las Vegas shooting. This is something that you can use to modify an AR-15 to make it fire more rapidly. But isn't it true that without a bump stock, you can fire one of these semi-automatic weapons pretty rapidly just by the way you hold your finger on the trigger?
You can make a change to the weapon to make it an automatic weapon.
Even without altering it, even if you loop your finger through your belt loop and then hold your finger in a certain way with an AR-15, you turn it into essentially an automatic weapon.
I mean, that's the danger of having these weapons on the street. They are so easily, so easy to kill a lot of people. And you can do a lot of things, even at the semi-automatic rate. You are firing rounds so quickly in a place like a small church. You are hitting nearly everyone in sight. It is incredibly dangerous. These are not meant for our streets. This is not the Founding Fathers' vision. These are meant for the battlefield. They're weapons of war.
Talking with Andrew Patrick, he's media director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Of course, the NRA and other groups who are very conservative say, look, the reason why we have these guns is that we don't trust the federal government. And if the federal government comes after us, if suddenly the federal government turns hostile toward the people, we'll be on the front lines fighting against the federal government. What do you make of that?
I think that's more fear-mongering from the NRA. They see that more and more Americans are talking about this issue, more Americans are voting on this issue, more Americans are becoming hip to their game of fear-mongering and scaring the American public. We've seen gun sales go down this whole year in the age of Trump, clearly, the president is bad for business on their end, and they need to find ways to incite more fear in the American public and make them go buy more guns.
But the NRA says, look, you've got to have these guns. They're a bulwark for the people against an intrusive federal government. You say it's fear-mongering, but that's how they sell guns. That's how, during President Obama's administration, the NRA and other groups suggested that President Obama was going to go after their guns and their ammunition. President Obama laughed and joked about that at the end of his administration, saying, where were all these gun confiscations? They never happened. But, there are some people, I think, out there who sincerely believe that the federal government's going to come after them and try to take their guns. What do you say to those people, some of whom are listening right now? What would you say to those people?
Well, first of all, it's not true. No one's looking to confiscate guns of legal, law-abiding citizens. We respect their Second Amendment rights. We respect their right to be able to hunt, to protect themselves. They don't need an AR-15 to do that. And as Scalia said in the Supreme Court decision, the Heller Supreme Court decision, like all rights, the rights guaranteed by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. So we can have sensible gun reform, we can have stronger gun laws, and still be in line with what it says in the Constitution.
Mm. Do we have a right to be free of gun violence? And what is your group to do to try to stop stop people who have guns from infringing on the rights of all of us, the rest of us that don't have guns?
Well, I think a dangerous precedent that's happened in the last few years is the rise of open carry. The gun lobby, for a long time, the NRA liked to talk about this slippery slope argument, where we have one gun law, it's going to lead to the next gun law, and then they're going to take all your guns. We know that's ridiculous. We know it's not true. The real slippery slope exists on their side, where they want to put more guns in schools. They want to put more guns. They want you to go to church armed. They want you to go to the bar armed. They want you to go to the restaurant armed. They want you to show up in an Arby's or a Chili's or your child's ballet recital armed with a weapon. That is the real danger, is putting more and more guns into our society and pushing it onto us, when most Americans just want to the right to live free, like you said, live free from gun violence.
So how can those of us who don't have guns have the right to be free from gun violence?
Well, I think this is an issue where you can get involved. We need more people voting on this issue. We need more people talking about this issue. For the longest time, one of these mass tragedies occurred, and people forgot about it in a matter of days or weeks.
But Patrick, why doesn't your group advocate for something like the freedom to be free of gun violence. That is that, you know, sure, people can have an AR-15, whatever, but the rest of us have to be protected from the misuse of that weapon. Those folks in Las Vegas were not protected from the misuse of that weapon. The folks in that church Sunday morning were not protected from the misuse of that weapon. Do you advocate for people to have the right to be free and secure in their homes from, you know, random shootings and all that? I mean, what are you doing to advance that cause so that all of us can be free, if we choose to not have guns, to be free from being shot from these crazy men that are out there?
Well, as we've heard for a long time, guns don't kill people. People kill people. We want to take guns from the dangerous people, the people who intend to do harm to others. And that's why we work with our allies and in states around the country to pass laws that remove guns from dangerous people. And I think the majority of Americans, the majority of gun owners, the majority of NRA members agree with that sentiment.
But shouldn't we have the right? Shouldn't we have the right not to be shot?
Absolutely. That's what we're working for.
You know, what about insurance on guns? Should we require people who have guns to carry insurance so that when that gun is misused, and they often are misused, that there's insurance for the families who are victims of gunshots?
I think we should make sure that people who have guns are properly trained and know how to use them. Many states don't even require training for permits, concealed carry permits. So I think the way that we do that is make sure that if you're saying you're a responsible gun owner, you know how to use that gun responsibly, and you're not leaving it out so a child can take it and shoot themselves or a family member. You're not leaving it in a bathroom somewhere. You're not firing it in a random place. I think more people we can pass stronger laws that have the people who have guns properly know how to use them, and I don't think that's unreasonable.
Here, I'm calling you from this place in Tampa that has a serial killer loose, and the shooter has shot people at random. If there were fingerprints on the ammunition and on the gun, tying the ammunition or tying the projectile to a certain gun, it would be a lot easier to find who this serial killer was. Do you advocate fingerprinting bullets?
We have worked hard for called micro stamping, which puts a serial number on the bullet and would match it with the casing. And we think that can solve crimes. Many of these crimes, it passed in California, and gun manufacturers said we don't like it, so they would move out of California and will not manufacture new guns in California as long as that law is in place. I think it's a law that could go into effect other places and really help actually solve some of these random killings that we see across the nation.
So when you go to lobby in the legislature in California, go to lobby in Washington, D.C., in terms of folks that want to prevent gun violence and the folks that want to have more guns in the hands of more people, more ammunition in the hands of more people, what's the ratio of lobbyists?
I wouldn't know. I don't really have a great answer for you. I'm down in Richmond, Virginia a lot, and I've seen a lot of citizen lobbyists, whether it's activists or people who are involved in the issue or just simply care about it, more than I've seen armed gunmen lobbying. So there's the gun lobbies had a stranglehold on our political system for a long time that's slowly breaking with each one of these tragedies. It gets lesser and lesser. And it's something that is a marathon, not a sprint, and we're going to continue working on it.
All right. Well, Andrew Patrick, the media director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Mike, my pleasure.
Andrew, if people want to find out more about the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, how can they do that?
You can visit our website, csgv.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and follow us on Twitter at CSGV.
All right, Andrew Patrick, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's Andrew Patrick with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, today, 100 years ago, was the end of the Russian Revolution in 1917. And we're going to hear a speech. We're going to try to get most of it on. A speech about the Russian Revolution right now comes to us from Alternative Radio. And this is a speech about the revolution and what were some of the problems and also what were some of the things that went wrong at the very beginning. So we'll hear this speech. David Barsamian will introduce it from Alternative Radio. And we'll tell you more about the speech at the very end. This is WMNF 88.5 FM.
Our guest today is Todd Kreshin. He's a member of the International Socialist Organization and is a frequent contributor to Socialist Worker and the International Socialist Review. He's the editor of Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution. He spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago.
Why do we talk about the Russian Revolution 100 years later? For much of the previous century, for let's say half or two-thirds of it, the Russian Revolution had a material direct impact both on states, capitalist states hostile to it, and on generations of workers in their millions who understood the Russian Revolution as a critical touchstone in history, as a defining political event. That if you understood someone's attitude towards the Russian Revolution, you understood a lot about their worldview, about the question of trade unions, about the liberation of the oppressed, about the capitalist state, about war and peace. The Russian Revolution for generations was a defining political event for millions of people. I would argue that today, because of Stalinism, because of McCarthyism, because of the long period of time which has elapsed since the revolution, we are no longer in a period where there is an automatic social, cultural understanding of what the Russian Revolution presents. We have a lot of talk in the press, but it's probably uncommon, or actually we don't have that much talk in the press. We have a little bit of talk in the press. Bhaskar Sankara published a very interesting piece in the New York Times referring to the Bolshevik Revolution. Tariq Ali also was in the New York Times on the question of Lenin and the revolution. So there is some talk in this 100th anniversary, but it is not a question of your cousins, your uncles, your aunts, your brothers, your sisters understand and have been told the story from their friends and their parents of the meaning of the Russian Revolution. That cultural history inside the working class, at least in the United States and in many places in the world, has been obliterated by Stalinism, by time, and by repression. So when we talk about the Russian Revolution, one of our tasks is understanding, is it simply a historical anomaly that is interesting, and there are many interesting things. Studying history, I would argue, is intrinsically wonderful, and everyone should pursue it. But is there something more to it? Why should we study the Russian Revolution? Why should young radicals today who care about Black Lives Matter, who care about the environment, who care about equal pay for women, who care about abortion rights, who care about transgender rights, why should people caring about trade unions and $15 an hour care about these strange people called the Bolsheviki and the Russian Revolution that happened 100 years ago? And I would argue the following, and then we'll get into the history of what actually happened. Our responsibility as revolutionaries today is to learn the history of the revolution, extract its key lessons from that history, and make them available today for a new generation of people for the following reason. There have been many revolutions since. There have been heroic mass struggles against oppression. There have been tremendous strike waves all around the world. But the Russian Revolution is the one time in the working class's history where we were able to pass over from resistance to everything that they do to us over to power, over to being able to remake the world in the way that we want to remake it. That is an experience that is singular to the Russian Revolution in its depth and complexity and meaning. And that is why we have to carry those lessons forward. There's no other terrain in which you can learn the uses of proletarian power, the impact of workers being transforming themselves from an oppressed class into a class in power and beginning to remake the world. This is a whole bunch of strategy and tactics that most workers have never had a chance to play out in a historical situation because the struggle was always circumvented, was always cut short before they got to their October. So with that proviso, I would say that we have a responsibility as revolutionaries not to assume that other people will care, but to understand that our task is to study the revolution, learn its lessons, and bring those lessons to the fore for a new generation of people. I don't think, my guess is, that the Russian Revolution will not be the main cultural marker for mass struggle in the United States. People will not make a socialist revolution in the United States in the main with the banner of Lenin. They will make it with the banner of Malcolm X, with Martin Luther King, with our cultural heroes in this country. However, the cadre of that revolution cannot be a cadre that can win a revolution without understanding the lessons of Lenin and the Bolsheviki and their friends. So it is not a question of everyone in the world has to know this or there's something wrong with them, but if you want to be a revolutionary and an effective socialist revolutionary today, you are hamstrung until you understand the meaning of the Russian Revolution. So that's my proviso. Now, what happens? This is what the first lesson of the Russian Revolution. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through sort of the months. I'm not going to attempt to do a narrative. Thankfully, China Mayville has just written this wonderful new book called October, which I think is the heir of Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. If you want in 300 pages to understand or begin to understand the Russian Revolution, read China's book. It is a masterpiece, in my opinion. So I'm not going to try to read it page for page, as much as that is tempting. What I want to do is go through a little bit of the narrative so you have some points to understand the pace of events, but also try to draw some lessons out of each phase. So, why do we care about the Russian Revolution, and how does it? What is its impact at the time? This is what Victor Serge said about the meaning of the Russian Revolution back in 1918. Victor Serge was an anarchist who went over to the Bolsheviks and became an important writer and figure that people may have heard before. So this is what Victor Serge says. He says, riots in Paris, riots in Lyon, revolution in Belgium, revolution in Constantinople, victory of the Soviets in Bulgaria, rioting in Copenhagen. In fact, the whole of Europe is in movement. Clandestine or open Soviets are appearing everywhere, even in the Allied armies. Everything is possible, everything. This is Victor Serge's assessment of the impact of the Russian Revolution into the war-ravaged countries of Europe. And I won't go through the quotes, but the leaders of European capitalism essentially agreed on the danger from the opposite point of view. What then do those mass upsurges mean? And what I want to do is attempt to sustain an argument throughout the course of this talk about power. That we, as I said before, are very accustomed to resisting. How many people here have been on protest in the last couple of that? Basically everybody, right? And if you weren't, I'm sure you wanted to be, right? So our movement and our tradition, we look to resistance. We look to people fighting the power, but we have almost no examples of ever becoming the power. And often we get torn in small circles of believing that the chairperson has power. I'm going to resist the chairperson. Mistaking what is real social and economic power for small fights amongst the left, small fights amongst each other. One of the things about the Russian Revolution is to identify the sources of real political and economic power in society. And as Marx argued, that starts with capitalism, the meaners, the owners of the means of production, and the job of socialism is to overcome that power and to replace it with a new sort of power. I'll just paraphrase Marx says in the German ideology. He says the production of mass consciousness for communism must take place in a practical movement, in a revolution. And therefore, a revolution is necessary for two principal reasons. One is that the old ruling class cannot be overcome in any other way than a revolution. That is, they're simply too powerful with the means of their disposal to relent and allow social justice without a revolution. And that's important, and I think people instinctively understand that. You look at our government, and it is a brutal and brutalizing institution, and it's difficult to imagine the powers that be in this country simply giving up power. The banks handing over their money, the Pentagon withdrawing its 155 bases around the world, etc. The prison system voluntarily shutting down. We understand that they have power and some mass upheaval must take place in order to challenge their power. The second part of Marx's emphasis, though, I think is even more meaningful and more important for socialists. And what he says is, not only do we have to overthrow the old ruling class, but in so doing, in the process of a revolution, the oppressed class, the working class, must become fit to found a new society. That is, only in the process of revolution can working class people overcome, as Marx says, all the old crap which has been drilled into them for their whole lives. So this process of revolution is necessary to not only defeat the forces that be, but in order to create the unity and the power and the ability within the working class to rule in our own name. So that's really why the Russian Revolution is critical. So why is it possible in Russia? Why does it break through in Russia? I'm not going to go through all of the ins and outs again, but here in a nutshell is the situation in Russia. And understanding this from the point of view of both objective circumstances, this is a big thing you're going to hear Marxists say all the time, objective circumstances and subjective circumstances. In February, the war had been raging for 3 years, several million Russian soldiers dead or missing, several million civilians injured or displaced, starving to death. The country is being torn apart. The conditions for the capitalist class in Russia were intensifyingly bad and going from bad to worse. Obviously, the conditions for workers and peasants in Russia were even more dire. So you have, on the one hand, a system of crisis, system of capitalism that is in the deepest crisis that any major capitalist state has ever faced in the Russian Empire. On the other hand, you have the subjective. You have a working class which is small but extremely combative, condensed into big factories in the major cities, that has a tradition of having lost a revolution in 1905, and not simply lost a revolution in which there were a few protests, a few attempts to go on strike, but a revolution in 1905 that came close to pushing the Tsar out of power. And the price the workers paid in 1905 for almost winning was 15,000 executions, 30,000 people into exile, and a mass repression across the country. So the working class learned in 1905 that if we are going to rise up, we better have a plan to win. If you push the Tsar halfway, he will come back with wrath and fury and execute your family. That's the lesson that people learn in 1905. And it creates a tremendously radical, politicized working class. So it is not the question of a small, isolated, intellectual socialist movement over here and a passive trade union movement over here. Rather, it is a working class that has been both brutalized, but has already had a sense of its own power. And I'll go through the parties in a minute that represented it. But those are the two forces that begin to clash in February. And long story short, the old Tsar, his armies collapsing, his military in revolt, the workers on strike, the peasants rebelling, he finally decides to call it quits. And the workers overthrow the Tsar, they get rid of the old monarchy, and now the question is, what sort of government will replace the Tsar? And this brings us, so that's the February Revolution in very short order. In March, the beginning of March, because it's sort of February and March, there arises two competing institutions which are potential sources of political power in Russia. And this is what we refer to as dual power. How many people here have heard of dual power? So like half the people. Okay, so a little explanation. Dual power is a scenario that arises fairly commonly in mass upheavals, where a old bad government gets pushed out of the way, and usually there's some sort of ad hoc institution which claims to be a better form of the old government that steps in and declares that it will take care of things. And we've seen this happen many times in history. In the case of Russia, a group stepped forward calling themselves the Provisional Government. And this was more or less an ad hoc group of people who are well-known politicians representing a spectrum of opinion from fairly conservative aristocrats all the way over to moderate socialists. The Provisional Government. There wasn't an election for this Provisional Government. There was a thin reliance on a series of old undemocratic elections that the Tsar had permitted to found this new government. But in essence, it was an ad hoc government of politicians trying to say, we speak in the name of the people, and eventually, There'll be some elections to codify our power. But for the moment, we speak in the name of the revolution. So that's the provisional government on one hand. On the other hand, the other side of dual power is an institution that rises up called the Soviet. And the Soviet is just a Russian word which means council. But we still insist on saying Soviet instead of council. Accident of history. So the Workers' Council, the Soviet, began to represent through direct elections the peasants, the sailors, and the soldiers, and the workers. So what you would do is we would have a factory, and we'd say there's a couple hundred people here. We all get a delegate. So who would like to vote? Who would like to be the delegate? There's a Bolshevik, there's a Menshevik, there's an SR, there's a Menshevik Internationalist, there's somebody else, there's an anarchist, there's a more conservative worker. We debate, we decide, we vote. That delegate goes and represents our factory at the Soviet, at the Workers' Council, until we decide that we want to replace them, and we can replace them at any time. So that institution, the Soviet, is very direct democratic organization of the masses, begins to compete with the provisional government. And in some sense, the story of the rest of the revolution is the competition between these two institutions. Will we go back to a provisional government which relies on the capitalist class and a relationship with the capitalist class, or will we go forward to a new form of democracy, direct democracy based on the Soviet, based on the working class? This dual power is very unstable, and it's very new. So one of the things about the dual power is that it's surprising. The provisional government, although it still represents the old order in some way, doesn't do so in a crude, conservative manner. So this is what Claude Anet says. Claude Anet, who was a French officer who was in Russia at the time. This is what he says about the provisional government. He says in March, "The government was granting everything which was asked of it. We want a free Poland, free, united, intact, say the Poles. You shall have a free Poland, united and intact," answers the provisional government. The women say, "We want the right to vote." "You shall have the right to vote." The different races are agitating. Equality of all races, of all religions, everyone's right of admission to all offices, abolition of all restrictions. And the government said, "We are decided on equality." In the dawn of liberty, the government refuses nothing. All desires are crowned. All prayers received a favorable hearing. Ask for the moon, it will be given to you by decree. But I am inclined to think that the government knows very well what it is doing. It understands the Russian mind, which requires fine promises. And in reality, what does it give? Lavish promises. And meanwhile, time passes. We shall thus pass from material impossibility to material impossibility, to postponing the elections until after the war. That is the only reasonable solution. And Claude Anet is a he's a sort of sympathetic to the moderate socialist, totally hostile to the Soviet and to the Bolsheviks. But he does a wonderful description of the government's maneuver. In the face of a mass revolt, the liberals promise and retreat, and they bide their time. That's the program of the provisional government. So that counterposed to that is the Soviet. This is the Soviet's conditions for supporting the provisional government, at least partially. And this is the first order that the Petrograd Soviet gives out. Think about this. Election of soldiers' committees in every military unit, election of their representatives to the Soviet. Subordination of soldiers in the Soviet in political institutions, subordination of soldiers to the military commission, that is a joint commission, insofar as, again and crucially, as its orders do not deviate from the Soviet's, control of weapons by soldiers' committee, military discipline while on duty with full civil rights at other times, abolition of officers, honorary titles. So this is a... If the provisional government is promising change in the future, the Soviet at this point, the coalition of socialist parties representing the working class, is granting to the soldiers essentially veto rights over the high command and the democratic election of delegates within the military to then veto military policy and officers' authority. But they're saying, "You're in power, we'll share it. All we want is the right to veto everything that the military says during a war." And you think, oh, that's a nice deal, right? I guess we can all get along. We can all agree on that. So if the provisional government is promising change in the future, the Soviet government is threatening change in the future. And these two forces exist in an unstable alliance. Now, that's the picture in March. In April, Lenin comes back from exile, as most of the socialist leadership was exiled during the period between 1905 and 1917. Lenin and a bunch of people come back through a series of very strange maneuvers. They get through Germany on a SEAL train. Both Lenin and Martov, by the way, the leaders of the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, all do the same thing, so we'll leave that aside. But they get back into Russia, and there is now this question posed within the Bolshevik Party about how do we understand this tension between the provisional government and the Soviet government. And Lenin lays out this very ingenious description of the different parties' positions that are involved in this whole process. There's a group called the Cadets, which are essentially, I'll call them the Democratic Party. They are the liberal aristocrats and middle class and capitalists, and they, of course, wanted to work with the Tsar. They wanted a constitutional monarchy. When the Tsar abdicated, they were left without a monarchy, so they were trying to keep things as little change as possible, although they wanted universal suffrage for men. And that's a big change from an autocracy, so they did want some change, but they were basically trying to keep things in check. So this is the Cadets. There's a group called the Socialist Revolutionary Party, and they are a party both based on support of the peasantry, but also radical intelligentsia. And they are for redistribution of the land, and they have some very radical demands, but are also sort of caught between whether or not we should overthrow capitalism or we should try to negotiate with capitalism. There's the Menshevik Party. Very quickly, I'm just going to do shorthand, which is Menshevik means moderate socialist, Bolshevik means revolutionary socialist. But the moderate socialists get pulled in two different directions because they really do want socialism, but there's a debate about can we overthrow capitalism now? Can we end the war now? Can we redistribute the land now? Or do we have to find a way to come to an accommodation with the capitalist class and only get those reforms that we can work out without creating an intense crisis that will rip the country apart? They are stuck between this position of we want socialism, but in order to get socialism, we have to wait for a whole historical period for the country to develop. In the meantime, we need to have some sort of semi-unity with at least some of the capitalist class. And that is a very difficult contradiction. And in fact, the party gets pulled in two different directions. Lenin comes back in April of 1917, and the Bolshevik Party, in my opinion, has an attitude towards the provisional government, which is that they do not trust them. The provisional government makes its promises, and we do not trust those promises in the main. That the bulk of the Bolshevik Party believes that workers have to continue to fight, that they should not rely on the capitalists for anything, that they should not trust the other more moderate parties, that they have to immediately end the war, they have to take any actions necessary to end the war, redistribute the land, the workers should take over the factories. An extremely radical revolutionary program. But they are stuck in a bit of a position about what do we do about the provisional government, because it's promising all this stuff, and most people still support the provisional government, and we are a small minority at this point. We have 25,000 members. That's a very good number of members to have, but if you have 3 to 10 million workers, depending on how you count it, you're still a small minority. So if you want the working class to take power, but you are a small minority, and the workers don't yet want to take power, what do? In the meantime, do we attempt to come to some sort of accommodation with the provisional government, or should we push now for workers' power? Should we try to overthrow the provisional government? And a debate is raging within the Bolshevik Party about all these strategies and tactics. Lenin comes back with a very definite attitude, and he presents a thing called the April Theses and a series of other discussions, and his point is quite simple, which is that we have wanted a bourgeois revolution in Russia. We've wanted to overthrow the Tsar. The Tsar is overthrown. Now we're moving on to the second phase of the revolution. And in that second phase of the revolution, the contest will be between the provisional government or the Soviets. It can't be both. We should fight for Soviet power. And our slogan should become, although he doesn't use the words, they come a little bit later, all power to the Soviets. And in the meantime, because we're still a small minority, our job will be to explain to the working class why the only way to solve the questions of the war and capitalism and all the problems that go with it is that they have to take power through the Soviets, that they have to overthrow the provisional government and replace a reliance on the capitalist class or a coalition with the capitalist class with workers' power. And this thesis provokes a lot of debate in the Bolshevik Party. Some would say that Lenin came back with these ideas and almost nobody else had them. I think he certainly had a much more specific and definite attitude towards the question of the state because of State and Revolution, a book he was writing. But he was not alone in the Bolshevik Party in believing that the provisional government was the enemy and that the working class had to take power in alliance with the poor peasantry. But he helped galvanize that section of the party that was already debating and thinking through these ideas and win over the vast majority of the party in short order. Not only did he do so through the power of argument, but also events were moving very quickly. So if in late February and early March you could believe that the provisional government was promising to end the war, what happens in late April and May proves that the provisional government's promises should not be taken at face value. So there's a Milyukov, who's a minister in the provisional government, essentially promises France and Britain, they're about to be, that the allies, that Russia will honor its commitments and continue the war till victory. This becomes public, mass demonstrations are provoked, he's forced to resign from the government, and the working class understands that if the provisional government is making promises, at least some people in the provisional government are lying to your face. Maybe not everybody, but at least some of them. And so there's a lessons that are taking place very rapidly. So it's not just Lenin has a good argument, he convinces everybody. It's also that events are moving very quickly, and the logic of the government that is still in power, the provisional government, should not be trusted, is taking hold. So that's April. In May, as if to put a finer point on it, there's a socialist, a guy from the Socialist Revolutionary Party, or a faction of it called the Trudoviki, named Kerensky. And Kerensky becomes, he's sort of a strange figure. He's very dynamic, but also a bit histrionic, a little bit full of himself. You might have met people like this before. And that he comes to believe that he is the embodiment of the Russian Revolution. And at first is quite popular. He's quite a good orator. He has a record of being a lawyer defending workers who had been oppressed by the Tsar before. So he's not a nobody. He comes in to a historical situation and he says, I represent the Russian Revolution. I will speak in the name of Russian democracy. And he's both in the Soviet and in the provisional government. And he tries to walk this line. But here's why it gets very difficult to walk that line. As the war intensifies and the debate becomes war or peace, provisional government or Soviet, Kerensky is trying to hold these two things together. And this is what Kerensky does. He goes to the front and he says, we have to agitate amongst the soldiers, not to end the war, but to start a new offensive against Germany. And this is what Kerensky says. This is Kerensky's autobiography. Forward to the battle for freedom. I summon you not to a feast, but to death. These are the words that I used before the conference at Kamenets-Podolsk. These words were also the keynotes of my addresses all along the front line positions. This is what Lenin says. We call you to social revolution. We summon you not to die for others, but to destroy others, to destroy your class enemies in the rear. Then Kerensky says, this counter slogan of Lenin carried with it a terrible force, for it justified beforehand the animal fear of death, which lurks in the heart of even the bravest. And you can hear Kerensky. It supplied in the mind of the arguments the support of everything that was dark, cowardly, and selfish in the army. There is nothing remarkable about this, but et cetera. And then he and the provisional government, a month later, launch an offensive to try to defeat Germany. Basically, France is saying, if you want the money to keep coming, you have to fight. So Kerensky launches an offensive in June. It goes well for a few days, and then it's a disaster. And hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers are maimed, killed, or taken prisoner. A total disaster. So this, again, is a lesson. It's the Bolsheviks saying, all power to the Soviet. Workers can't trust the government. They have to take power in their own name. But it's also events that the provisional government, in the name of the provisional government, as Kerensky says, forward to battle for freedom. I summon you not to a feast, but to death. That is Kerensky's program, and people are saying, okay. There is a couple anecdotes I want to get to real quick in June, because I think to the question of power, the soldiers and the workers are instinctively becoming more and more oppositional, more and more radical. The Bolsheviks are becoming more popular. But at the same time, there's a difficulty, as we were saying at the beginning, of going from being people who resist to being people who take power. There is a difference between saying no to your boss and saying, We are removing the boss, and we shall now run society. That is a psychological barrier that, as an oppressed class of whatever race, of whatever gender, as an oppressed class, working class people are taught that you follow orders, you do what you're told. Sometimes if it's unjust, you may say, that's unjust, and I demand a different order. But at the end of the day, you are not the people setting the terms of exploitation and of political power. You are trying to negotiate with a hostile power to you. So going from resistance to power is a very difficult psychological leap. In June, there's a guy named Fyodor Raskolnikov, who is a young sailor who's a Bolshevik. And the guy's quite a character. You should really read about him. He and the Bolsheviks decide from Kronstadt that they're going to go on a tour of all of the ships that are embarked outside of Petrograd. So imagine this. This is the Navy. The Bolsheviks say, we're going to send around, it's actually through the Kronstadt Soviet, which was mostly controlled by the Bolsheviks, we're going to send our delegates to all the ships, call the sailors together, have meetings, talk about how we should end the war and overthrow the provisional government. Let's get in a rowboat, row out there, knock on the ship, climb up the gangplank, and here you are on the ship, and you say to the commander, we in the name of the Soviet demand a meeting on deck with all the sailors, and we want the officers below deck so that they can't hear what we're saying. Now, that's hard to imagine that happening today, right? But you still respect the authority of the officers. The officers still formally control the ship, even if the sailors have the right to have a meeting. And Raskolnikov, I think, has a wonderful anecdote to explain this. So they have the meeting. They say, oh, the Bolsheviks are pretty cool. We like them. And he says, as we are saying our goodbye to the sailor comrades and to the officers who stood nearby, I came upon one young officer who refused to give me his hand. I said, why didn't you give me your hand? He said, so the officer said, on account of your political views. And Raskolnikov says, the Bolshevik, but pardon me, I am a representative of a certain political party, and I honestly and sincerely express the views which I profess. Tell me why I should deserve to be treated with such contempt that you refuse to shake hands with me. And the officer says, I didn't intend to insult you. And I said, and he says, I acted as my feelings prompted me. And then Raskolnikov says, but if your feelings had prompted you to hit me in the face, then regardless of your intentions, that would have been an insult. And then the officer says, you consider yourself insulted, I apologize. He was confused. And I asked him to be more careful next time. And then Raskolnikov reports him to the ship's sailors committee and says, you should take action against this officer. That is right up to power. But it's still not power. It is saying to the authority, you must respect our growing authority. But it still acknowledges a different authority. I think it's a wonderful anecdote. This explodes in July, into the July days, which I talked about a little bit at the beginning. Because Kerensky's offensive collapses and it's such a disaster, the soldiers and the sailors revolt, the workers in Petrograd revolt, and the Bolsheviks are now stuck in the situation of being at the head of a mass revolt in the biggest city or cities, mostly in St. Petersburg, in which it's clear that the provisional government, with Kerensky at the head, I represent the Russian Revolution, I summon you to death, and then people follow and they die, and people now say, who you have lied to us, you represent the continuity with the old regime, we want a revolution, the Bolsheviks have been talking about a revolution, the Bolsheviks have been talking about all power to the Soviet, now is the time. With guns in hand, tens of thousands of soldiers and sailors and workers into the streets demanding an overthrow of the provisional government, but only in St. Petersburg. And this then presents...
Well, there is a partial insight into the months of... 1917, during the Russian Revolution. That's a speech by author Todd Chretien. It comes to us from the Alternative Radio series. He is a fan of Lenin, but not a fan of Stalin. And you can hear more of that speech. If you want to get a full copy of it, you can call Alternative Radio at 1-800-444-1977. The Russian Revolution took place 100 years ago today. And in the background, we're going to listen to some of the music from Reds in the scene where the revolution succeeds. 100 years ago today. There's no official celebration today in Russia. There's a great new book out by China Mayville, who is normally a fiction writer, but he wrote a book called October, which is kind of a popular history of the Russian Revolution in October of 2017. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up. I know the show has been all over the place, but you can call up and express your comments at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Biro. He's coming up next on the Midpoint program. This is WMNF Tampa.